So I'm just going to start with a quick review. Last time we were concerned with constructing general relativities of quantum field theory. And I tried to follow the same steps we do for our other field theories. We defined a symmetry. We identified the source that we want. We gauged the symmetry to get the source. And then there's a bunch of symmetry relations that follow from doing that. And I've in the review, I put all the indices back in. So the indices are here for all the different objects. But basically, the idea is by defining symmetry transformations in the fields, you can get a invariance. The connection that you need here has a gauge transformation. Which I've written out there. We then follow our nose and write a field strength tensor. The interesting feature of doing it this way, since we haven't assumed anything but general covariance at this stage, is that we need a couple extra conditions to get general relativity. We assume symmetry for the connection, and we assume the metricity condition, then we get general relativity. So once we've done this construction, make these assumptions, we're in general relativity that you know and love. And if you do that, then the connection is the Christoffel symbol, the usual way. So this explains why there are sometimes cousins of general relativity out there. There's small clusters of people doing various things that are slightly different and come with different names. If you don't assume symmetry for the connection, then you won't get that relation. You'll have an extra degrees of freedom, which is called torsion. This is the Einstein-Cartan theory. If you don't assume the equivalence principle, you can get non-metricity. There's extra degrees of freedom associated with that, metric affine theories, where the connection has some dynamical properties. And those come with subdivisions inside themselves. So there's no point in me reviewing that. But if we then just specify this general, went specifically to the Einstein solution, we get the classical part as equations of motion. We get the quantum mechanics out in the Schrodinger equation and the force laws. And we get the quantum field theory out as output from this construction. We also got Feynman rules for the various terms, and we did one calculation. And the point of that calculation is a bit of foreshadowing that when we start doing these calculations more completely tomorrow, we're going to get terms that are, from our field theory point of view, surprising initially, in that we don't get back the original Einstein action. The Einstein action is first power of the curvature. We get back things that are second power in the curvature. And so we're going to have to do something a little different than our usual things. Today's topic is effective field theory. So that's all review. Anyone want to ask something, I'll be happy to do it, but that's the review. Okay. Today's effective field theory. I'm going to do it with two examples. The one is QED with a heavy top quark. So here's the synopsis of that. We start with the QED Lagrangian, including a top quark, with the path integral is defined by integrating over the fermions in the gauge fields. But since the top quark is heavy, it's not relevant for most of our lives. We can integrate it out from the theory, and we end up with an effective Lagrangian and only the photon left. Plus, you know, anything else that we want to put in, but this part is I've integrated out the top quark by doing the path integral over its variables, and I get an effective Lagrangian with a term that looks like F box F. Okay, so that's the synopsis of that part, and that just lets me say a bunch of effective field theory words along the way. Okay, the more interesting one and the one that's closer to gravity is the linear sigma model. So here, this starts with a set of fields, pi's and phi's. Phi's come in three types in this particular realization. This is your standard symmetry breaking model. Sigma picks up a vacuum expectation value. It becomes heavy. So when I'm living at low energies, I can integrate out the heavy field. So the full theory is defined by that. And I end up with an effective field theory at low energies. And that effective field theory is going to have this form here, which is a little surprising. It's not going to be obvious until I do it, I hope. Well, maybe it is to you if you know. But this is going to have an exponential of the field. It's a new field. It's not exactly the phi field. It's a new field, pi. It lives in an exponential, so it has infinite number of terms in there. It comes with a Lagrangian that has two derivatives sitting there and four derivatives sitting there and, in principle, higher derivatives. And I will determine the coefficients in this Lagrangian by matching to the full theory, so by basically doing that integrating out to one loop. And the answer is, this is the equivalent to the full theory at low energies when those parameters are chosen to be whatever they are there, you know, v squared over 8m sigma squared plus 1 over 192 pi squared, blah, 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 okay? So there's the synopsis of that guy. Okay, so let's start that. Let's start and see our theory evolve. So let's do first is the QED example. QED with a heavy top. Good thing you're not seeing all this. It's my screen's going a little haywire here, and I have to. I'm going to have to live with it. All right, so what I want to copy over here is the vacuum polarization for, okay. I want to copy this guy. And put it back over here. There we go. So QED with a heavy top quark at one loop, I'm going to integrate it out. And this really is just the following diagram. It's just the vacuum polarization diagram. The vacuum polarization diagram is a function that when calculated in dimensional regularization has the behavior that you see there. The limits of that when the mass is heavy is given in the second line there. So when the mass is bigger than the energies involved in the vacuum polarization, I have that second line. That's the one I'm going to be playing with at the moment. And the effect of that is to take the usual propagator and modify it to 1 plus pi of q squared. Okay. So we've modified it in that way. Now, I think everyone here knows some of the story. some of the story is this is, has a divergence in it. The divergences are going to disappear in renormalization. So the 1 over epsilons disappear. That's fine. But it looks, if I do that, it still looks a little surprising. It looks like I have a residual dependence on log mt squared. Okay. And that residual dependence should scare you then, because, well, one, it looks like the electric interactions that if I do this, depends on the top quark mass. And that's even more worrisome, because we might not know other masses that are yet heavier and the dependence on those masses. So it almost looks like we can't even do QED this way. And the resolution to that actually is completely relevant for effective field theories. And the point is that renormalization is not so much the removal of divergences. Divergences are probably not really there. Okay, there's probably some theory ultimately is finite. Maybe it's string theory, who knows. But they're probably really not there. So that doesn't matter. Renormalization is really a theory about measurement. To renormalize something means to measure it. And we don't know these parameters ahead of time. We don't know the electric charge. But what we do know by measuring at low energies is E0 of 1 plus pi of 0. Okay, it's that. That's our electric charge squared. Let's put a 4 pi in here so I can write the number. 1 over 137. Okay. Once I do that, there's no more MT dependence left over in the log anyhow. So let's write the, take, let me quite correct that a little bit. Because that's gone. There's a Q squared over MT squared piece here. The residual dependence is Q squared over MT squared, which is tiny if you're at ordinary energies and the top mass is as big as it is. This is an illustration of the Applequist-Carazon theorem. Which, since I don't want to write too many words here, is basically heavy effects go into renormalization, into renormalization and measurements parameters, or suppressed by heavy masses. Heavy scales. And this really comes, so this is what you've seen demonstrated there. You lose your main dependence. It's not that the electric charge doesn't depend on the top quark mass, but it's buried in the measurement. And after you've measured, you've only got residual effects that you could in principle see by varying Q squared, but they're suppressed by heavy masses. Okay. The effective field theory logic that we're using here is that is basically the uncertainty principle. The uncertainty principle says that if you're very heavy or very large scales, it implies it's almost local. It's local in position space. So the effects of very high energy scales look like things that are local. And so if they look like something a local Lagrangian, so this means a local. Local Lagrangian, and that implies there's some coupling. Okay, coupling constant in there. And so you see the effects of heavy physics as coupling constants in local Lagrangians, and that's what we see. So if we then match the residual effect to a local Lagrangian, the Q squared over MT squared effect, Q squared looks like a derivative operator. So this looks like if I had added a little extra interaction here, that looks like F mu nu box over M squared F mu nu. So basically it's an interaction involving the two photons, but it's local. It has a Q squared, so it's like box. And it goes like 1 over mt squared, so it's suppressed. And that's the piece I wrote out there in the introduction. If you do it carefully, you get the matching coefficient being the electric charge of the top quark, 240 pi squared mt squared, f box f. And that's, you know, it's part of, leftover part of the electromagnetic interaction. What I'm using here is power corrections are always going to have this form. So if I do integral d, if I'm looking at the effect of something that goes like q squared to the nth power, I'm going to look at the Fourier transform of d4q, 2 pi to the fourth e to the I q dot x of something that looks like q squared to the nth power. I would write that as, I can pull out the q squareds by going, making it box to the nth power. So each time I act on this thing with box, I get a power of q squared down. And the integral with the q squares pulled out is a delta function. So I get a delta function of x. So all the power corrections that one sees in amplitudes look like local corrections in a local Lagrangian. So anytime you can Taylor expand your result, you're local. On the other hand, if I go back up here to this amplitude, when the other case, when the mass is small or negligible or beyond the scale, or q squared is beyond the scale of the mass, I have logarithms. If I look at that, so stuff that's non-analytic, such as the integral d4q over q to the fourth, 2 pi to the fourth, e to the I q dot x log of q squared. This is some function that's not local. You can't Taylor expand that. It's not proportional delta function. And in fact, if you, it's actually a very funny little function if you're careful about it. But it roughly scales, as you can see, just by power counting, like 1 over x to the fourth. And potentially logs in that also. Okay, so dimensionally it looks like it's falling off. So it gets, at large distances, it's big, but it's sensitive to some region around the source. Okay, so this dichotomy will be important in effective field theories. Logarithms come from long distance physics. Power corrections can be replicated by short distance physics. Okay, so that's got, and then I guess the other thing that's worth pointing out is that in my original expression here, there will be higher order corrections too. I'm ultimately using an energy expansion, so there'll be higher derivative local terms also. So I'll have locality and an expansion in the energy. Okay, second case. Any questions about that? That's model number one. Got me to say things about locality. Apoquist carousel. Yes?
Why we are considering local terms?
Well, so local terms arise automatically when you integrate out heavy effects. We will see Lagrangians that have local effects that are non-renormalizable, and we'll learn how to deal with that. But local terms of arbitrary dimensions are natural when you integrate out heavy effects. That's the lesson here. We've integrated out the top quark. We get arbitrary numbers of local terms in an effective Lagrangian that represent the effect of that heavy quark. Okay? If you're interested in a certain level of precision, you keep a certain number of terms. Okay. Nonlinear sigma model. I'm going to write out that one model three ways. I'm going to, probably the most usual way that you've seen it. So this will be notation A. I'm going to let the sigma field, which picks up its vacuum expectation value, be the vacuum expectation value plus a fluctuation. So this is like the Higgs, you fluctuate around the minimum. The Lagrangian that I had before, I'm just going to write the whole thing over again. It's 1 half d mu phi d mu phi plus 1 half d mu sigma squared minus m sigma squared, this is sigma twiddle squared. There's minus lambda v sigma twiddle squared plus phi squared minus lambda over 4 sigma twiddle squared plus phi squared squared. Okay, so this is after I've expanded around the minimum. I get a massive scalar. I get the Goldstone bosons. And I get a set of interactions with no derivatives in them. Okay, they're just polynomials. right, let's do a better notation. I'm going to let sigma, capital sigma, be this original sigma plus I tau dot pi, tau dot phi, sorry. These are still the original fields, sigma and phi, that I had before. There's nothing changed there. Then I note that trace sigma dagger sigma. So the tau is these, the Pauli matrices, 2x2 matrices that you're familiar with from spins. Trace sigma sigma, 1/2 of that is sigma squared plus pi, phi squared. So all those terms in the original Lagrangian that were symmetric can be written using this. And notation, better notation, is that the Lagrangian is 1/4 trace d mu sigma dagger d mu sigma plus mu squared over 2 trace sigma dagger sigma minus lambda, and I'm sorry, that 2 should have been a 4, and lambda over 16 trace sigma dagger sigma squared. So I have really not changed anything at all in this. This is just the original Lagrangian, just rewritten in a funny notation. Beauty of this notation is that it shows a symmetry, that this has a symmetry where sigma goes to a transformed sigma where L and R are SU2 matrices, independent SU2 matrices. Because if they're SU2 matrices, they're unitary, and then when I take the traces, that's invariant. So in this case, the trace sigma dagger sigma is invariant. So, all right. Okay, so we have this this anyway, we've got the symmetry notation built in, so it really has that advantage only. It doesn't have too many other advantages. But C is going to be the best notation. Okay. In this notation, I'm going to take this sigma that I have and write it as V plus S times U. And U, I'm going to write as e to the I tau dot pi over V. Okay? So this is just a change in notation at this stage. It's really mixing up what I called previously sigma twiddle and phi. So basically, if you start looking at this, S is equal to sigma twiddle plus corrections in terms of the other pi and sigma, and phi, or pi, is equal to, if I expand that to first order, pi is phi plus field redefinitions.
Are pi the goldstone?
Yes. So phi were the goldstones already up here, up in the first original notation. So phi looks, has a kinetic energy piece, is that. Because of this property right here, the fact that the first term is linearly related, pi will also be a Goldstone. You'll have exactly the same kinetic energy, but the interactions are going to be screwed up or mixed up, okay? But the kinetic energy will be the same, and so this property tells us that the kinetic energies are the same and the masses are the same. Okay, so that's the important part of this particular field redefinition, is it keeps the kinetic energies and masses unchanged. Okay, and if I write this Lagrangian out, it's V plus S over 4, that's squared, trace d mu u, d mu u dagger, minus lambda V S cubed minus lambda S to the fourth. And then there's a 1/2 the kinetic energy if I expand this funny trace term out to first order, I'm going to get d mu pi with a v squared, and I'll get exactly the same kinetic energy as before. These are all without any approximations, so no approximations here. Okay, these all are identical theories. They are exactly the same theory. They give all the same scattering amplitudes. There's a theorem, Hogg's, which is basically what we all just say is field redefinitions can be done without changing scattering amplitudes. I just call it names don't matter. Basically, all scattering amplitudes are the same. On shell, where scattering amplitudes are defined. Feynman rules are going to change. Lots of things change. And the conditions for Hogg's theorem is the one I built in here, that the kinetic energies are unchanged. So if you think like an experimenter, kinetic energies are what you get when you have the particles by themselves. Those are the same each way. You throw them together, you see what happens. They come out scattering. Same things happen no matter how a theorist chooses to name things in the middle. That's Hogg's theorem. But this is completely non-trivial in these different conventions here. In the first one, I've got only interactions without derivatives. In the last one, all of the pion fields only have derivatives. So something funny is going on there. And so how this works out, so A and C give same amps. So if you want to see it precisely numerically, go to the dynamics of the standard model, which you now all own because it's free, because you dutifully downloaded it, chapter 4, where I wrote that section. You work out the scattering amplitude, and you see how it works precisely in the Feynman rules. But let me just do the cartoon sketch for you. The cartoon sketch is that in A, you've got something like that, which is lambda. It was lambda phi to the fourth. And let's make all these things pions. You also get things that look like this sigma twiddle exchange, pi, 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 pi. And none of these have any, well, the couplings don't have any momentum dependence, so these are just constants. So the first one is just a constant. This one has some energy dependence because there's a propagator. So what happens is the first term is 1 in some numbers. The second term is minus 1 in those numbers. And then I get q squared over m sigma squared. Q to the fourth. I'm Taylor expanding that propagator, m sigma to the fourth, etc. When I use amplitude c, we can come up here and we can see it. Our Feynman rules, all the pions are going to have only derivative interactions. So pi, 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 pi. So this guy here is going to go like energy squared. There's two derivatives. And it's going to go 1 over v squared, just because that's the only thing that's floating around there. There'll be, if I try adding this guy in, it's going to be energy squared up here, energy squared up here. So it's going to go like energy to the fourth over v to the fourth. All these amplitudes, by the way, are dimensionless. That means the phi to the fourth interactions. So dimensions have to be compensated by powers, some powers. So this is going to look like q squared over, well, it's going to happen to be m sigma squared once all the numerical factors come in. But that's just from the first one. The first one does it all. The second one does q to the fourth over m sigma to the fourth terms. So what's happened here is that these two Feynman diagrams in one representation are compressed into the first one in the second representation, but the amplitudes are the same to all orders in the expansion, and all other amplitudes are the same too. This tells us that we're better off in the using that last representation. But moreover, we can simplify things. We can imagine writing out a energy expansion here where I know the various terms in it. I'm going to try to write these guys out. The first one, you can see, just looking at this, I just drop the S. So I get the Lagrangian is v squared over 4 trace d mu u dagger. The second one, I'm going to have already have a trace d mu u dagger at each of those vertices and a 1 over m sigma squared. I get, if I put the numbers in, it's v squared over 8. M sigma squared trace d mu u dagger quantity squared. Okay, so I'm now working by just looking at factors of the trace term. Okay. And this Lagrangian will give the first term in the energy expansion. And I can keep this up and write out other ones and reproduce all of the scattering amplitudes at low energies in using this effect of Lagrangian because pions only enter at that level. So I've produced my start of an effect of Lagrangian that reproduces the tree level scattering amplitudes. Yes?
In this notation, is the second term the four vertices?
The second term, though, is the leading term of the exchange diagram. So this is exchanging an S. So to leading order, this is 1 over q squared minus m sigma squared. And I'm neglecting the q squared. Okay, so I just take one over, I take a upper vertex is the trace, the lower vertex is the trace, and the one over m sigma squared, and I've just put in the proper numbers from actually doing it. Okay, so this is looking good. I've now, it's already pretty non-trivial because I've got all those powers of the pion field. That gives me all the various possible amplitudes, and they're supposed to be exactly the same. That's something powerful. But I'm going to go further. But an effective field theory is a full quantum field theory. Okay. And so what I'm really going to want to say, let's see if that's good, is that the what I have in my parameterization C is this field theory that says ds d pi e to the I, well, let's forget the integral sign, just call it L effective, L of sig s and pi. And that's going to be written as the integral just over just pi. I'm going to integrate out the s, e to the I, some L effective. It's only a function of the light degrees of freedom. Okay, and I've essentially done the tree level integrating out. I'm just doing tree level diagrams, and that's what I got up here. But now let me do the whole thing. What this in general means is includes loops. And loops are, it seems like it's going to fail, but it will not fail for reasons that we've already discussed. So the full theory at one loop is going to have the following types of diagrams. There'll be contact interactions with the pions and sigmas. So here I've got my external states are going to be these pions, that's fine. Inside here there's going to be pis or scalars. Either happens. There's going to be ones that look like that, s. There's going to be ones that look like, well, the reverse of that, various other diagrams like that, s going down there. There'll be ones that look like s and s. So everything up here is pis. Maybe you put pis there too. Okay, so all that stuff is present in the full theory. And I don't know if anyone here has actually done a box diagram. So this is, those are bubbles, triangles, and boxes. Box diagram is an enormously complicated diagram. What I like to do sometimes when I'm doing these lectures is I pull out a paper that's called a simplified expression for the box diagram. And you go through, and the simplified expression is 10 pages long or so. Yeah, okay, they're really complicated functions. The effective field theory at one loop is that. Pis, only pis, because I only have pis left in the effective field theory. That's very simple. We can do those in our sleep. How can these two be equivalent? Well, they can be equivalent at low energies because we've shown the equivalence of the vertices at low energies. So low loop energies. So the external energies are definitely going to be low because they're pions and we're using them at low energies. But the loops will go over all energies. But we showed that when the loop energies are, when all the energies are low, we've showed the equivalence of, you know, this plus this equals L effective. So here's L effective here and L effective there. So the diagrams, so here's a vertex, dot, 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 dot. Here's another part of a vertex. Here's another part of a vertex. We've shown that those pieces are totally equivalent when the low energies are low. So this will tell us that they're equivalent at low loop energies. At high loop energies, they won't be. Okay, so everyone agrees on that. But the high loop energies look like local Lagrangians by the uncertainty principle. So if everything in that loop is high, it looks like some local Lagrangian. And so the mistake that I make there can be adjusted for by choosing the coefficient of the local Lagrangian. So you have a local Lagrangian with some coefficient. You choose that to match the full calculation, and you're done. So you have to do something, but your low energy parts are unchanged. So let's do this. Let's just put EFT to work. Okay, the first step I need to do is I need to be a little bit more general than I have been. I've given you a specific Lagrangian that came at tree level, but I'm really expected to write the most general one because I don't really know that that's going to come out of the full integration. So I need the most general one. Consistent with the symmetries and the energy expansion. So I will do this as v squared over 4 trace d mu u, d mu u dagger. And in some sense, it defines the coupling v. And I'll give the second one a general coupling L1 trace d mu u dagger quantity squared. That's the one. That's squared up there. That's the one I had already, and I need another one. So part of the work at this stage is identifying the minimal set. The new U dagger, and trace. Let's see if I can squeeze it in. And this comes with a coefficient L2. Okay, so let's do the calculation in both limits. And I'm not going to actually do it, so I'm going to cheat by trying to copy it from something else. Let's hope this copies nicely. I want to copy it. All right, I'm going to copy some of it and try to then copy the rest later. Okay, so if I do the calculation for the full theory, I get this is one particular amplitude. It happens to be neutrals off of charged, but it's just the calculation I did. You get T, S, T is the, is the, is Q squared, P1 minus P3 squared. It's the momentum transfer in the T channel. And I get some amplitude. So there's what a scattering amplitude looks like. It contains powers. It contains logs of the Mandelstam variables. S is the center of mass energy squared, P1 plus P2 squared, and U is minus S minus T. S plus T plus U equals zero in this case. So that's the scattering amplitude. The effective field theory, I do the same calculation in the effective field theory. It's a much simpler calculation. It gives me the results that are given here. It has these unknown parameters, L1 and L2, which I showed you before, but you'll notice it has the same logs. Okay? That's important. The logs have to be the same if this is going to match, because L1 and L2 only modify the powers, the analytic, the local stuff. Logs can't be local. We told you that already. So the fact that the logs come out exactly the same is a success. And the coefficients there, I've actually made a renormalization. So let's go back and try copying the rest of this. All right, so let's go to copy function. Get back here, paste. All right, okay. So I've renormalized by the following trick up there. I mean, the original error one, L1 is the bare one. I absorbed the 1 over epsilon and some constants into it. But that's what we do when we do normal renormalization. And then we notice that we get the exact agreement if we choose these L1s and L2s to be a particular form. And so the effective field theory reproduces the result of the full theory if with these choices. These are the special choices. What's not obvious from what I did here is that those choices are going to work in all cases. So I've done one reaction. Nevertheless, that's going to be the claim. I'll show you at least the renormalization is universal in as part of the remainder of the talk. But at this moment, it's one reaction. You say, well, okay, I can do it. But if you do every reaction and you choose these particular ones, they're going to agree at low energies exactly. So that's powerful stuff. What we've done here is one of two ways of proceeding through effective field theories. You have to either match, which is what we did here, or in cases where you don't know what the coefficients are, you don't know, perhaps you don't know the full theory, or perhaps it's too complicated, you may want to measure. So most effective field theories, you do one of the two. Either you know your full theory and you do one calculation to match them, and then you use them in lots of other calculations, or you measure them and then use them in a lot in one reaction and use them in a lot of others. But still, it's powerful stuff, because now I never have to look at that effective field theory, that full theory again. All the complications of that full theory have been reduced to two numbers. Once I have those two numbers, I have all my low energy reactions. There is also a power counting theorem, which we can see. So actually, does anyone want to ask a question at that stage? Yeah.
I wasn't beautiful, but there's a lot of invariance on the redefinition of fields.
Yes.
Is it valid both for in-out matrix elements and in-in?
Yes, as far as I know, I don't see any differences between in and out, in and that's just, you just do, the different parts of the calculation carry different I epsilons in different places. So it's the same field redefinition will work everywhere.
Yes.
Yeah. Good question, though. I had not thought of it, but I can't, standing here in front of you, I think that's the answer. Anybody else? Okay. One thing else just before we move on is that there is a power counting theorem. And we can sort of get that just by, so it's proven in typical Weinberg fashion, such that he hits you over the head with it and you can't deny it. But nevertheless, it's also not the most obvious thing to stand here and say. It actually turns out to be, in this case, just counting of dimensions. In the effective field theory, that vertex is dimensionless. So I take a matrix element. This goes like e squared over v squared. If I use that in a loop, I get e squared over v squared from here, e squared over v squared from here. Without doing anything, I get some v to the fourth down here, because just because that came at each of the vertices. I get some function of energies up here, but by dimensionally it has to then be e to the fourth over v to the fourth, because it's dimensionless. If I do the same thing at two loops, I get e squared over v squared, e squared over v squared, e squared over v squared gives me e to the sixth over v to the sixth. And so you see, just by counting powers of this coupling constant that's entered into my perturbations, that each time I do more loops, I do higher powers of the energy. And so the truncation that I gave right there is appropriate for one loop, because I've got up to four derivatives. If I'm going to do two loops, I should carry out, write out this expansion to higher orders, and there'll be more terms. So there's an energy expansion going on. Okay, so that's that example. Worked out. What I'd like to do next is, in this context, I'm going to be aimed to show you that those renormalizations that I gave you to define those coupling constants have to be universal. In other words, if I want to show that no matter what reaction I'm doing, I'm going to have to get the exact same divergences that will be absorbed in the same terms in the Lagrangian. Okay, sounds like a daunting test, but it's really not so bad. And the trick for making it not so bad is this background field method. So I'm going to talk about background field method. And we're going to use this in general relativity also. I should say, let's stop and reflect that you should start seeing the connections between this and general relativity already. The first term is much like the Riemann curvature. It's an infinite expansion in the fields. With two derivatives, the second term is like curvature squared terms. four derivatives, but infinite expansion in the fields. So the techniques that we're doing here are basically the same that we'll do for general relativity. But if I want to do this a little bit nicer, I'm going to invoke the background field method, which allows me to renormalize all processes at one time. In fact, lets me calculate all the logs too, if you really come down to it, though I'm not going to focus on that too much at the moment. So the game plan is the following. I'm going to look at my original matrix U. Remember, that was the exponential of the pion field. I'm going to expand around some background value of that. And the expansion coefficients, there's various ways to choose this. I'm going to choose this to be the e to the I delta. And that's actually going to have three components. Delta in this is tau I delta, tau A delta A. Okay, sums over all there's three fluctuations. So I've got a background field, and I've got something that I'm going to treat as the quantum field or the fluctuating field. Okay. I'll take my original Lagrangian. I'm just going to use the lowest order one, is L. It'll be U bar, where I have no powers of the fluctuating field. It'll be L1 of U bar and delta, which is going to be linear in delta, and L2 U bar in delta, which is quadratic, plus dot dot dot. This first term is going to vanish by the equations of motion. Because the equations of motion are gotten by having the vanishing first derivative, their first variance. There's a question here?
Yeah, to be clear, yes, delta is supposed to depend on time.
Delta is going to be a full quantum field of x and t. And we can sort of see what the second variation is going to do. There'll be times where the derivatives act on the field delta. There'll be times where the derivatives act on the field U bar. The structure that emerges is L2 is 1/2, yes, delta A something delta B. And there'll be two types of terms here. One is going to be d mu, things that involve derivatives, which I'll define a little bit better, and there'll be sigma. Sigma depends on the background field. D's are going to depend on the background field. But D is going to start out as d mu plus gamma. Okay. So gamma, basically there's going to be a two pure derivative term. There'll be a one derivative term and something, and a something term with no derivatives. And I separate them into two derivatives, dd, partial, the one derivative term is partial gamma, and then the no derivative term is gamma gamma plus sigma sigma. Okay, so it's an easy construction. It's just a bunch of algebra. Sigma is going to be a gamma is going to be a function of the background field. Okay, I'm going to then pull out the divergences. And the whole game is how to do that, but let's write the answer. So the divergent part is, it's 1 over 16 pi squared, 1 over epsilon. And the answer is 1/12 gamma mu nu plus 1/2 sigma squared, where gamma mu nu is formed by the commutator of d mu with d nu. It's like a field strength tensor. Yes?
So I could scroll up a little bit.
Yes, please. Sure.
Yeah, the a and b, are those like exponents or
Okay, I'm sorry. This is a matrix.
Okay,
since all these things are matrices in SU2 space, A and B carry SU2 indices, and so I should have written that. Thank you for catching me.
Thanks.
Okay, yeah. So these are both matrices. Okay. This particular combination here is a special combination. It's in fact universal, and actually it's not. I'm not quite done. It's the trace over this because those were matrices. So the same answer to the previous question is that they have to be traced over. But if I take any theory now, this is sort of a universal feature. If I expand around. This is any scalar theory, expand around some background field, I can always stick it in this type of form. I've sort of done it by construction. I've got two derivatives. I write it as dd plus sigma. And I've got that answer. And then without even knowing what the rest of the theory is, I get this as a divergence. This is the A2 coefficient and is A2 Seeley-DeWitt coefficient, okay? So it's a fancy name for it, but it's basically what the answer is in essentially any theory. In particular, if I did scalar QED, DD would be partial derivatives with gamma being the photon field. The scalars would be the scalar QED piece, and I'd get F mu nu, and no sigma. I'm done. I've renormalized QED in one step. Okay, and so I've pulled out the divergences in one step. So once I do this once and for all, I've done it basically for everything. But now the feature is this is a local Lagrangian. And so it can be expressed in terms of terms in the local Lagrangian. In particular, it can be expressed in terms of L1 trace squared plus L2 trace, like before. Those are the only terms that are there. And so when I'm going to, in this method, renormalize the whole Lagrangian at once by absorbing this 1 over epsilon into these coefficients the way that I did in the individual reaction. The numbers turn out to be the same. So I renormalize all processes at once. Okay, so that's the beauty of this method. The game is to then actually do it. So I'm not going to write out all the terms. Let's see if I can find them here. Okay, so here's the answer for the case that I did. I have to write something out first. No, I don't. It's there. Copy this. Copy. Put it back over here. It doesn't come in. We'll look at it over here, and oh, there it is. It finally comes in. Jeez. So in the case that we were looking at there, this is the answer. I've copied it out of Dynamics of the Standard Model, but those lambdas are the tau matrices. I just copied from a different place. Okay, so I've done that. I have that expression, just functions of the background field, nothing special. And then I have to evaluate the divergences. I can do it in two ways. One way, they're both a little fancy, but only a little. The first one is a little fancy. If I have the integral d delta integrating over these guys, e to the I integral d4x delta dd plus sigma delta, as a path integral, this is the determinant of d mu. So the formula looks like this, sigma to the minus 1/2 power. And I write this as e to the minus 1/2 trace log of d squared plus sigma. So at that stage, I'm looking fancy. But then I now get a little bit more concrete trace log d mu plus sigma can be written as trace log box plus some interaction V where that's gammas and sigmas, which can be written as trace log box 1 plus box over 1 over box V. Looks lovely, which is then trace log box, but then I can, it's trace log 1 over box V. I expand that as 1 over trace, so it's trace 1 over box times V plus trace 1 over box V, 1 over box V plus dot dot dot. And now we start looking concrete. One over box means a propagator. That's the Feynman propagator, x minus y. Trace means integration over position and trace over the momentum labels. So this first term here is really the diagram where I have V here. Box comes from x back to x. This looks like the integral d4x, d of x minus x, v of x. That's the tadpole diagram. And if I go through the fancy little details, it's the same. The other one, 1 over box v, 1 over box v, is the bubble diagram. V, so I'm at x, I go to y, go to x. This is v of x, d x minus y, v of y, d of y minus x, integral d4x, d4y. And I can evaluate that. That's the bubble diagram. And that's where actually my divergences live. The next one in the expansion is the triangle diagram. The triangle diagram, the scalar triangle anyhow, is not divergent. But in the end, I can sum these, I can do these diagrams, Feynman diagrams. And I get the result that I got before. Okay, so you can do this in, my point is, you can do this in a essentially standard perturbative calculation by just doing Feynman diagrams. Or you can be really fancy and use the heat kernel. Which is a fancy way of saying let the mathematicians do the work for you. The heat kernel is an object. If I have a differential operator D, the heat kernel is a function of x and tau, the x matrix element of e to the minus d times tau. So whatever my differential operator is, tau x. And here I'm going to choose d in this case to be the d mu plus sigma plus m. Puts m squared. I'll just put an m in there just to be case. And if one starts the evaluation of that, this looks like I over 16, well, it's I over 4 pi to the d over 2. That's the 16 pi squared that we had before. E to the minus tau m squared over tau to the d over 2. And here are the coefficients a0 plus a1 tau. These are the Seeley-DeWitt coefficients. Tau squared over 2. These are Seeley-DeWitt. And these then determine then if I want x log d x, I get this from the heat kernel by doing minus the integral d tau over tau of the heat kernel x e to the minus tau d x, which then has the expansion. If I do that, I get I minus I over 16, no, 4 pi to the d over 2, sum m to the d minus 2n gamma of n minus d over 2 an. Okay, so this is the formulation. The beauty of it, as far as renormalization theory goes, is that the gamma of 2 minus d over 2 piece is associated with a2. So if I let the mathematicians calculate this function, you get the A2 coefficient, which is the one I gave you before. In this case, I'm going to just look at the dynamics of the standard model where we do the calculation. So since you all own that now, you will find in the appendix a discussion, the appendix B1, a discussion of this, and it's not that terrible to calculate. So there's my differential operator. There's the definition of heat kernel, and here I've inserted a complete set of states XP. P, etc. Okay, I put momentum states in around it. And then, which is just exponentials. Then I commute the derivatives with the exponentials. I do some integrals. There's some integrals. There's the integrals. And I get the heat kernel expansion, which I showed you before. So that's the derivation that's needed to do it. It's not that terrible, but you don't want me to write out every step of that here. The only thing that you see here is that I've thrown away a total derivative. There's, in general, the heat kernel coefficient. If you're using it for other things rather than Lagrangians, you might want to keep that total derivative. And it has many uses. So anyway, this gives you the same A2 coefficient for any theory that you can put into that form. So our strategy next time, we'll be doing something similar for GR. We'll do a background field expansion. When the time comes, we'll wave our hands and say heat kernel, and we'll give you the answer for what the heat kernel is, and we'll renormalize general relativity by doing that trick. Okay, there's a question in the back.
The divergence at t equals 4.
Yeah.
It is artifact of which assumption?
Just the fact that I've chosen to do these integrals in dimensions other than 4. Okay, so if I'm choosing to do this, the integrals in other dimensions, because then I can make them well defined in some dimension and then extrapolate back to d equals to 4.
This is specific to this and this example, right?
Yes.
What other examples, d equals 4, can or cannot?
Oh, you can use this in other settings. If you're doing two-dimensional field theories, you might be interested in d equals to 2. Okay? This setting is not just restricted to d equals to 4. You saw the expansion there in terms of the powers d. The one thing I didn't do is that original expression on how you get the tau to the d over 2 in the denominator. But it's almost dimensional analysis at that stage. Okay. Great. I finished exactly on time. There you go. Thank you.